Hey, thanks for stopping by Fox Local for HTX at 10. We're just getting settled in here. I'm Sally Mack. We've got a lot to talk about this hour, so we're glad you're on board. I know you're curious about the work week forecast, perhaps, and there will be some big changes at the end of the week, but right now, it's muggy, it's steamy, it's perfect weather for crawfish ice cream, which I noticed was staring you in the face, Mike Iskovitz, right across from the Weather Center.
Well, can I tell you, I'll be honest, I grabbed a vanilla.
Oh, they did have plain vanilla?
There was one.
Oh.
Yeah, and I also, I'll probably bemoan this, as Lena would say, but yes. I did grab a churro also, because they were really good.
Fancy looking.
I've tried, you know, look. I've done the crawfish. She's wonderful, you know.
Red Circle ice cream. Yeah.
But I've done the crawfish and I didn't really like it. I don't want to make an issue out of it.
It's not for everybody.
All right. Well, my earpiece just went out. So.
Oh, bummer.
Oh, no. It came back in.
Oh, good.
What? Let me walk over here before it goes out again. So here we go. Let's talk about. You know, Sally mentioned it. There's a lot to watch this week, really. I mean, yeah, we're talking about warm, humid weather, but we also have storms that are going to be just skirting by to our north. So notice this. Well, we can call that a gradient if you want to get really fancy, of rainfall. So like lighter here and then heavier here and then heavier there. And that's the way in general things are going to be setting up this week. But we're still going to get sort of a near miss by some tough thunderstorms. So that actually goes for today and tomorrow. Most of the action well to our north today. But if you're up around Bryan College Station or Huntsville, you do have a chance of maybe getting a brief visit from some thunderstorms. Same tomorrow. And then heading into Wednesday, we have a better chance, mostly, especially north of I-10, a better chance of getting in on maybe some decent downpours. Some of those may linger into Thursday. And then Friday, more widespread light rain or moderate rain. So we'll keep an eye on these rainfall amounts and severity, but right now the highest chance will be Wednesday night and then again on Friday. In the meantime, here's what we've got there out there for you. We have winds out of the south. So south wind at 15 miles per hour, pretty healthy there for Sugar Land. A south wind at 15 miles per hour in Huntsville, gusting to 22. So that's just pumping in all the humidity for us, but also for North Texas and all the way up to Arkansas and all the way back up to the Midwest, tapping into that rich Gulf moisture. We have temperatures right now that are rising into the low 80s, and we should make it here to the upper 80s and some low 90s later today. Notice here on the future cast, we do have a little bit of rain that just barely, like I said, kind of approaches from the west and then fizzles out. A similar situation for tomorrow. The bullseye, though, is right there in the middle of your screen. When we take a look at 1 through 5, with 4 being a significant risk for severe weather, it is right there, Missouri and Illinois. That's where the highest likelihood is. But sometimes you could have tornadoes that form outside of that brightest area. So Memphis, Little Rock, back over to around Indianapolis, all those areas, even as far to the south as places like Texarkana, Texas, also at risk for seeing tornadoes today and maybe even some large ones. But this is where the highest risk will be. Places like Paducah, Kentucky, St. Louis, back down to Little Rock and Memphis. Those are areas we'll have to watch really closely for the tornado threat. We've already had several reports of wind damage here across Missouri, and this very fast moving line is likely going to produce some really high winds there to the north of St. Louis, as well as the chance for some tornadoes forming out here preceding the line. So this is where the majority of the heavy weather will be today. But by late in the afternoon, there's a chance that some new activity out to, let's say, forming in the hill country could just barely skirt by Bryan College Station, Huntsville, Crockett, Trinity. You guys just watch out for that. As far as tomorrow's severe weather outlook, it is to our north, primarily, not a big risk for us. And then we do get in on this low-end risk for seeing some stronger thunderstorms coming up on Wednesday, and it does look like it'll be primarily Wednesday night. So let's check out our future cast. So a muggy morning gives way to a breezy and somewhat hot day. No, of course, it's not hot by June, July, or August standards, but for this time of the year, it is a little bit early for us to head into the low 90s or at least upper 80s, especially now with that heat index above 95 degrees. So just keep that in mind. Middle to upper 70s overnight tonight. Tomorrow, just a very slight rain chance, 91. We'll also have a good chance of hitting 90 on Wednesday. But remember, as I mentioned, Wednesday night could bring us some thunderstorms, especially north of Houston. We'll have some rain around on Thursday, and then we actually start to cool down with some rain on Friday, followed by what could be lows in the 50s this weekend, which is pretty amazing when you consider we're going to be making it here into the low 90s for the next couple days. So, boy, topsy-turvy forecast. Just the way we like it, Sally.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Just the way Houston seems to like it.
That's
okay.
Right.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate
it. Sure.
Well, at the state capitol this morning, there is a hearing that just got underway moments ago here with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle coming together to talk about the Hill Country flooding nearly 1 year ago. It's been now. So let's take you to Austin and listen in as this hearing gets underway right now.
But for me, one thing is clear. This tragedy could have been prevented. Our goal with this investigative committee is to examine the facts, understand where failures occurred, and determine what must be done to ensure that it never happens again. Finally, I want to express my appreciation to Lieutenant Governor Patrick, Speaker Burroughs, Chairman Meyer, and the committee investigators, and the members of both committees. The work required here is difficult, it's serious, and deeply important. It is being undertaken with the gravity and the diligence it deserves. Chairman Meyer.
Thank you, Chairman Flores. Good morning, and thank you for being here. Whether in this room or watching from home, we know that for many of you, this is not an easy day. First, I want to thank Speaker Burroughs and Lieutenant Governor Patrick for their leadership in ensuring that this committee was established and given the authority necessary to carry out a thorough and independent review. I also want to recognize Governor Abbott for his commitment to ensuring this investigation moves forward with urgency and transparency. We are here today because of the lives lost and families forever changed by the devastating flooding that struck Central Texas in July of 2025, and in particular, because of the tragedy at Camp Mystic. Those children and the families who entrusted them to that place deserve answers. Our responsibility is clear, to determine what happened. That means building a complete, accurate account of the events, the decisions made, and the timeline of what unfolded. The facts must be established with clarity and without omission. Next, our job is to assess preparedness and response. We will examine whether the systems, protocols, and personnel in place were adequate, and whether they functioned as they should when lives were on the line. That includes the actions of agencies, officials, and individuals at every level. This committee will follow the facts wherever they may lead, including examining decisions made before, during, and after the flooding to understand whether more could have been done and what must be improved moving forward. I want to express my appreciation for the investigators chosen to assist this committee. Casey Garrett and Judge Michael Massengale bring a high level of professionalism, integrity, and experience to this process, and we are grateful for their service and dedication to uncovering the facts. To Chairman Flores and his committee, thank you for your leadership and collaboration as we work across chambers to get answers for the people of Texas. And to my fellow committee members, I am grateful for your willingness to serve in this capacity. The gravity of this work is real, and I believe each of you feels it. It will continue to demand diligence, fairness, and an unwavering commitment to getting this right. Finally, to the families who lost loved ones and the communities that are still healing, we understand that no proceeding can undo what has been lost. The grief you carry is immeasurable, and the courage it takes to be here or to watch from home is not lost on us. This moment carries real weight, and we do not take it lightly. What we can offer and are committed to is a process grounded in accountability, transparency, and a full examination of the facts. You deserve to know exactly what happened and why. This committee will not rest. I guarantee you, we will not rest until we have done everything within our power to provide that. Thank you. Members, does anyone wish to say anything? Speaker Moody.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer, Chairman Flores, and echo everything that you all said. The amount of trauma and tragedy that came down in the Hill Country last year is something that is still very hard to comprehend. And there's nothing, and you all have said this, there's nothing that legislators can do to change that. And that does, I think, at times make us feel very helpless. But I think the goals of what the chairman have both stated it is what we're here to do. And I know we're going to hear from some folks that have suffered the largest loss that we could ever imagine. But our task in front of us is what we can do to prepare better, to make sure that in crisis the response is adequate, and that in the aftermath of a crisis we are caring for people and not re-traumatizing them. I also know, and I want to appreciate everybody mentioning our investigators and the team that went out there, because the painful stories that we have heard and will hear have all been channeled through this team. And it was 4 years ago, almost to the day here, when I first met Casey, Mike, and their team, when we went down to Uvalde. Casey, when I saw you last week, all of that rushed back, I know, for you and for me. So as we hear from Casey today, just understand, she's asked to do this work because she is brilliant, and she is hardworking, and she knows how to get to the truth of the matter. But she is a human being who is absorbing a lot of very difficult information, seeing things and hearing things that no one should have to. And I want to thank you for your work and your team for your work, because it's incredibly difficult what you do. But I want to say thank you. And just as we go through today, just know that we are here to support you in all the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Speaker Moody. Members, any other? All right, thank you. Today, we will hear from the investigators tasked to examine the 2025 flooding event and to produce the briefing that we will see today. Members of the public can leave comments through the comment portal linked on both meeting notices online and posted outside the committee room. Members, I'd ask that you limit questions if possible during the investigators' presentation. There will be an opportunity for extensive questions and answers afterwards, and many of your questions may be addressed in the presentation itself. With that, the chair calls the investigators, Casey Garrett and Judge Michael Massengale, to present their findings.
Chairman Meyer, Chairman Flores, members of the committee, it's good to see you all again, and good morning. Thank you, Representative Moody, for those incredibly kind words. It means a lot to me. We did get quite close 4 years ago in Uvalde in very unfortunate circumstances, but I cannot thank you enough for those very, very kind words. As you know, my name is Casey Garrett. This is Michael Massengale. You guys have asked us to do a factual and objective investigation into the July 4th, 2025 flooding event. You specifically charged us with limiting our scope to the events at Camp Mystic, with some context leading up to and shortly after those critical hours at Camp Mystic. Obviously, I don't have to tell you that there's a lot of people that want the investigation to be more wide-ranging. Obviously, I leave that up to the legislature to take care of. I just want to make clear that our marching orders were to focus on the scope that you gave us, and we have done that. As Representative Moody pointed out, the way I got involved in this investigation was that 4 years ago I got a call from now Speaker Burroughs to help with the House Legislative Investigative Committee into the Robb Elementary shooting in Uvalde. Judge Massengale was also asked to participate in that, and that's where we became actually really good friends and colleagues. And I'm thankful for that experience. It was difficult, and I never dreamed that there'd be another mass casualty of children bigger than what happened in Uvalde. But here we are. I'd also like to introduce Heather McFarlane and Kim Parks, also members of our team. Kim and I met at the district attorney's office in Houston many, many years ago, 33 years ago. We were both longtime prosecutors, and we're both criminal trial attorneys now. Judge Massengale spent 10 years at Baker Botts, became a partner, then became a justice on the Texas Court of Appeals for 10 years, and is currently in private arbitration practice. Heather has also been an attorney, a civil trial attorney, for almost 30 years, and is also involved in mediation and arbitration. Essentially, in a very small but mighty team, you're getting about 120 years of legal experience. All of us as you know, as a living, investigate cases, interview witnesses, and write conclusions and findings, and that's what you're getting from us. This has been a very aggressive timeline, as you know, and we have dedicated really our entire practices to this project over the last few months. And I will say, completely honored, just absolutely honored. When Speaker Burroughs called me in the fall to see if we were interested in doing this, it was a hard answer, of course, but it was an easy answer. I'm excited that we have been able to be a part of this public service. So thank you for that opportunity. I do want to point out, I know that you guys are well aware of this, but it bears commenting on. Our presentation today is intended to be strictly factual. Sometimes it's a little bit hard to not bleed over into opinions, but we have tried really hard to keep this as objective and as factual as we possibly can. Unlike the litigation, right? Chairman Flores, you said it so well. This is not about judgment. It's about change. And every single person, including myself, is hungry for you guys to take the call to action and make some change that can make this tragedy at least, I mean, make a modicum of sense. So just wanted to point that out before we get started, but I'll just start with some of our source material. That 120 witness interviews is closer to 140 or 150 now. We will continue to interview witnesses as we lead into May and getting the final report written. I have personally interviewed every single family that was impacted by this. I have interviewed every single member of the Eastland family. I have interviewed parents of children that survived from the relevant cabins that children died in. I have interviewed campers. Although I didn't solicit talking to children, some of them wanted to talk to me and some of their parents wanted them to talk to me. I have spoken with counselors. I have interviewed witnesses in Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, Belleville. I've been on Zoom calls with witnesses from Poland, Maine, Tennessee, Colorado, Alabama. We have spent the last few months interviewing witnesses. And that's the only way to get the information that we need. So we've done that. We have been to Camp Mystic multiple times. Let me back up for 1 second on the witnesses. I would like to say that everybody, for the most part, with a few very minor exceptions, has been completely cooperative. Completely cooperative. We have had access to, again, all of the family members. We've had access to all of the Eastlands. All of the lawyers that have been involved have been tremendously cooperative. We've received information from the civil lawyers on both sides. We have really not faced any significant impediments other than people's trauma. And not wanting to talk so much about that. So I do want to point out how cooperative everybody has been. We have been to Camp Mystic multiple times. We have done site tours. We were given unfettered access. We did walkthroughs with members of the Eastland family. We didn't feel like we were impeded at all on that. Transcripts of all the hard work that you and some of your colleagues did last summer. That was a lot of really important information. 911 calls, audio witness statements, all the media reporting, newspaper articles, lots of information from the civil suits. Again, the lawyers have all been really helpful with this process. Reviewing information from both sides. We've attended as many court hearings as we can, and we've reviewed transcripts from those court hearings, which again have been provided to us by the lawyers. And then, of course, you guys know, and you know from the Uvalde experience, what a brilliant writer Judge Massengale is. He's been working on a preliminary report as we have been giving him information for this entire time. So you're going to see a really well-written report. Let's talk about Camp Mystic, because to understand some of this story, you have to understand Camp Mystic. And I think one of the things that helped me in this process is that I didn't know anything. I didn't know much about, I mean, obviously I know about the Hill Country, but I didn't know much about like the topography and that kind of thing. And I really knew nothing about Camp Mystic. Everything I know about Camp Mystic now, I learned from people in this room. But it's important, right? Because it's actually, what I learned is it's a culture. It's a thing. It's a very big part of people's lives. It is a Christian, private Christian camp for girls, located on approximately 720 acres. Again, having been out there, it's absolutely beautiful. It's just absolutely beautiful property. I can see why people have loved it for 100 years. It's absolutely beautiful. It was formed in 1926, again, 100 years ago. It was bought in 1939 by the Eastland family. It was run for many years by a beloved couple named Inie and Frank Harrison. When Dick and Tweety Eastland graduated from college, they moved to Camp Mystic to begin learning how to run it. They worked under the, Mrs. Eastland explained to us that they worked under the tutelage of Inie and Frank Harrison until they began to take over the camp in approximately 1987. It is currently separated into two campuses, the Cypress Lake campus and the Guadalupe River campus. The Cypress Lake campus is newer. I believe it was built in approximately 2019 and opened in 2020. And the Guadalupe River campus, of course, has existed since 1926. Some important things about Mystic, right? It's touted as rustic. It is rustic. It's absolutely beautiful. It's completely communing with nature as when they're out there. There's no air conditioning. There's no cell phones. These are long sessions that these girls go. They go for a month. They have very limited contact with parents. It's deeply religious, and it's definitely what I've learned is what I would call sort of an obedience-encouraged culture. These aren't bad things, right? It's not bad or good. It's wonderful for your child to be able to disconnect from cell phones, right? And really, everybody I talked to, including the counselors, said we loved not having cell phones. We loved having an excuse to disconnect. So it's not a criticism that they didn't have cell phones. It's just a fact. So regarding the obedience culture, again, that's not a bad thing. We want to teach our children to follow rules. We want to teach them to learn how to win or lose. We want to teach them to be part of teams and tribes. And that was very encouraged at Camp Mystic. But it was a play-by-the-rules situation. And again, I say that factually from multiple interviews of people that said things like, I would have gotten in trouble if I knew I couldn't do that because it broke the rules. I mean, it was a very rule-oriented obedience culture, and I think that also you'll see played out a little bit as well with the Eastland family and the way the family was run by the patriarch, Dick Eastland. Multi-generational. I mean, there are people in this room whose grandmothers went to Camp Mystic, whose mothers went to Camp Mystic, their aunts, their cousins, their sisters. This is a acceptance letter that Missy Peck received regarding her daughter Lulu. Since she's a relative of a former Mystic girl, she'll be considered a Mystic grandchild. It was an honor. Almost one-third of girls are Mystic grandchildren. It is great your daughter will be coming to continue the tradition. It was about tradition. It was about legacy. It's not to say that there weren't girls there that went and their mothers didn't go. That certainly did happen. But for sure, the lion's share of the situation was a multi-generational, put your daughter on the wait list at birth. This was, wives telling their new husbands that if we have a daughter, she'll go to Mystic. It was a known thing. It was a very traditional culture. So we talked a little bit about the two different campuses. Cypress Lake camp, and I'm so glad that you members were out there last week so you could get some perspective about what the layout is like. The relevant portion of our investigation is the Guadalupe River campus. So the Guadalupe River campus is, this cursor is kind of sensitive, there we go. This area right here, it's separated into these two basically these two major areas, the Flats and Senior Hill. Up this hill is the campus, Cypress Lake campus, that was unaffected for the most part by the floods. So let's talk a little bit about the hierarchy at Camp Mystic. What you're seeing here are the members of Mystic's year-round full-time staff. The executive directors, of course, were Dick Eastland and Tweety Eastland. And the two campuses each had their own directors. Britt Eastland and Katie Eastland were the directors of the Cypress Lake campus, and Edward and Mary Liz Eastland were the directors of the Guadalupe River campus. Mary Liz Eastland is also a registered nurse and was listed as the medical director of camp for camp the Guadalupe campus for Camp Mystic. Richard Eastland, the eldest brother, and I should mention that Dick and Tweety Eastland had four sons, Richard, James, Britt, and Edward. In a terrible tragedy. James Eastland, who was married with young children and working at the camp under the tutelage of his parents, unexpectedly and tragically died in his 30s of an unknown heart condition. And that sort of brought the family all back to the camp. We were told by the Eastlands that when James very unexpectedly and tragically died, Britt Eastland, who was working as an attorney in San Antonio, and Katie, who was working as a teacher, came back to assist the family in the wake of James's death. Richard Eastland is the head chef and kitchen supervisor. He's responsible for feeding hundreds and hundreds of girls three times a day over the period of the summer. Craig Althaus and Betsy Althaus were longtime personal friends of Dick and Tweety. Their kids grew up together. Dick and Tweety asked Craig and Betsy to come live on the property and work on the property many, many years ago, 25 years ago, I believe. And Craig became director of operations, charge of all the maintenance and the grounds, and Betsy became an assistant director working in the office. So this makes up the sum total of the full-time, year-round personnel for Camp Mystic. We learned, of course, that naturally when camp was in session, they had seasonal staff. So during camp seasons, you had Glenn Yankee and Lee Poole acting as night watchmen. Glenn Yankee tells us that he's a retired HPD officer who moved back to the area with his wife, and in approximately 2021 began working as a night watchman during the summertime, during summer camp sessions, working 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. patrolling the campus. Another local man named Lee Poole, I believe, shared that responsibility with Glenn Yankee. Francis Blackwell Loper is a full-time teacher in Lubbock, Texas, and in 2022, I believe, she started working in the summers as the gatekeeper. Francis's mother went to Mystic, Francis went to Mystic, Francis's daughter went to Mystic, and Francis very much, she tells me, wanted her granddaughter to go to Mystic, and she knew that if she was there working in the summer, that might work out well. So Francis was a beloved employee that worked in the summer at the front gate. Every summer, Mary Liz would hire a nursing staff. We are aware of three nurses that were living on site for the summer. They are listed here. Support crews. Britt is in charge of hiring grounds crew. They obtain J-1 visas for a group of people from Mexico, group of men that have also become a little bit of a generational cycle through Mystic. Fathers and sons and uncles and nephews continue to come back year after year to work the summer session as grounds crew. The kitchen workers, Richard Eastland is in charge of getting J-1 visas for kitchen workers, and over the years he has found that what has worked best is that there is a group of people from Poland they go through a group called Camp for America. They're young, they're college-age kids typically, who come over for the summer on a J-1 visa to work at the camp as kitchen staff, and then they can also travel in the summer before they go back to Poland. So there were a number of groundskeepers, more than 10, and kitchen workers from Poland. As far as summer leadership positions, they have a group of people called the Big Three. Now, to be clear, these are college girls. These are sophomores and juniors, roughly, in college. They are people that have been typically lifetime campers and have had at least a term as a counselor. So they're called the Big Three: program director, tribe director, and activities director. Sort of the supervisors of the younger counselors, but still college age girls. Additional staff include college age photographers and office workers. So this is essentially the sum total of seasonal staff, not including the counselors of each cabin, which we'll get to shortly. Okay, what's important to really know about the dynamic at Mystic was the role that Dick Eastland played as the patriarch of the family. There's no question he was considered the leader of this family and the leader of this camp. By no question, I mean literally everybody describes him in a similar manner, including members of the family, right? He ruled, Tweedy told us. He was large and in charge. He was not stepping back. Mrs. Eastland had already begun kind of pulling back a little bit, turning over a lot of her responsibility to Mary Liz and Katie and others. But Dick was still very much the executive director of the camp. Edward described, you know, if there was an evacuation plan, it was known only to my dad. Richard talks a little bit about, and this may seem silly or minor, but I think it really reflects the deep culture of this, right? They had traditions. There was a tradition that you had vanilla ice cream and fried chicken on Sundays. And if Richard, you know, wanted to change that tradition, that he was going to hear from his dad, is what he tells us. So a lot of micromanaging. And to be fair, he was the leader. And it was his way or the highway. Britt told us when we asked about the camp joining the American Camp Association, Britt said, "I think my dad is just old school. If you have too much regulation, no one is going to want to do this anymore." He would typically win those arguments. Craig described him as Mr. Veto, and they talked about him as the eagle and described him when he was on a tear, the eagle was swooping. Again, just a factual point that he was running the show over there. And in terms of that sort of obedience culture, I know that's a strong word, okay, but you just really didn't cross him. I mean, it was his word. He ruled, as Mrs. Eastland said. He won those arguments. Heard a lot from counselors about being very afraid of acting. And as you know, that's an issue, right? That we're seeing here is why certain people took action and certain people didn't. Well, they knew, you know, they said things like, "I knew I would be in trouble if I tried to take those girls up on that hill. I knew I would be in trouble if I tried to take those girls out in the lightning. I knew I would be in trouble if I ran to the front office in the dark, in the pouring rain," right? And again, to be fair, we want to teach our children to be obedient and respect authority, right? But we want to also, of course, give them the tools to feel like they can take action when they need to. Glenn Yankee describes Dick as the general. The Polish kitchen workers that we interviewed were really crippled with fear of interfering with campers. Naturally, it's no surprise that the male grounds crew were told to stay away from these campers, of course. They were to have no contact with campers, and that makes perfect sense. But same with the kitchen workers. They had limited contact with the girls, and they were afraid they would get in trouble if they interfered. But I also really want to point out, that the things I'm saying are not an indictment of him. It just describes what was going on there. Because he was deeply loved and respected. I mean, people have been very conflicted about their feelings about this family. He taught a generation of girls how to fish. He took them on raids of the kitchen. People adored and loved and respected Dick Eastland. Something that's obviously critically important to this scenario is the communication situation. The way the camp was set up for communications was that certain people had radios, certain people had the walkie-talkies. Dick and Tweety Eastland had a walkie-talkie, Edward and Mary Liz Eastland had one, Britt and Katie had one, Glenn Yankee, the night watchman, had one, Frances Blackwell Loper had one in the front gate. House. The big three had a radio where they stayed. They stayed in a cabin called Cozy Cabin, which I'll show you. They had a radio. And then there was a radio locked in a cabinet on the riflery range. And the riflery range is on Senior Hill, which that'll make sense in a second when I get to one of these maps. There were a few landlines. There was a landline in the infirmary. There was a landline in the front office. And there were landlines in each of the homes that the Eastlands live on. When you guys were out there with me last week, you saw that they all lived on the property, and I'll show you that as well in a moment. Cell phones. There were no cell phones for campers or counselors. There was Wi-Fi in a limited number of areas. The camp is set up with broadband and fiber. The PA system, the loudspeaker system. There's one by the office, and there's one on Senior Hill, and I believe there's one closer to the pavilion and the twins' cabins that we saw when we were out there last week. So as I said earlier, I had to learn a lot about sort of the makeup of the area, and I think that's really important in this equation as well. And one of the ways that I think we're best educated about that is a really good video that was put out by the Upper Guadalupe River Authority in 2017. It's about 10 minutes long. We're going to watch just a portion of it here in a second. But this slide shows that Dick Eastland also thought it was a really informative video, and he sent it to his family and some others, asking them to please watch this video. The video is called Be Flood Aware, we'll play just a relevant portion here for you.
The Guadalupe River originates in western Kerr County, where water from the Edwards Trinity Plateau aquifer pushes through fractures in the rock and begins to flow overland. These springs form the headwaters of the North Fork, South Fork, and Johnson Creek, and constitute the majority of the Guadalupe River's flow as it meanders through Kerr County. The geography of the land, including steep canyons, shallow soils, sharp elevation changes, and exposed limestone bedrock, are responsible for the nature of our river and creeks. Under normal flow conditions, these characteristics produce shallow, clear, fast-flowing streams that are a tranquil habitat preferred by abundant wildlife, swimmers, and fishermen alike. But during intense rainfall, that same topography causes the river to roar downstream.
The terrain here is unique for flash flooding. Hill Country has long been known as an area that receives flash flooding situations, mainly because we have limestone rocks. We have a very hilly terrain. It's not flat, so the water rushes down the hills. And if it happens to rain, especially above like the Guadalupe River, get up in the headwaters there where it's really kind of shallow most areas and a lot of limestone underneath, then you can get walls of water coming down. It acts like a street, like concrete. It just kind of rushes down, and you can end up, especially if it rains west of Kerrville up around Hunt and Ingram and westward, with massive walls of water coming down at the same time. So the topography is favorable for water to not just stagnate, but to rush down creeks, rivers, and streams. If you get 3 or 4 inches of rain at one time, that can be a real serious problem.
So I think that does a really good job of explaining why it is an area so well known for flooding and so prone to it. And that leads us to the flood history of the area, which I think is really relevant just discussing sort of what was known about the area for many, many years. This is a email from Dick Eastland to members of his family and others, talking about some of the flood issues. He says in the bottom of the email, "We've been here for some critical big floods, including 1978, 1984, 2000, and many others." And of course, this just reflects a knowledge by the Eastlands of how flood-prone this area is. And attached to that email, at the very bottom there, is a link to a summary flood history of Kerr County. And the next few slides are taken from that document that Dick Eastland references in this email about a flood history of that area. It goes way back. And in every one of these slides, we hear about, you know, an astonishing amount of rain, an astonishing amount of damage, an astonishing amount of river rise, 30-foot rise in the Upper Guadalupe, threatening to annihilate the village of Ingram. We're back in the early 1900s. In the 20s, a 15-foot rise on Cypress Creek, massive damage to people, lose their lives. In the 30s, of course, there's been much talk about the 1932 flood, the catastrophe of, it was a record stage, what they would have called in 1932 an unprecedented flood. 36-foot rise, 4 lives lost, countless buildings washed away, massive financial impact. Most notably is it's one of the earliest and first times that we see Camp Mystic affected by the flooding. Three cabins, the highlighted portion right here talks about how 3 cabins were washed away in the 1932 flood, 3 cabins that were closer to the waterfront. 1940s and 50s, torrential cloudbursts, millions of dollars in damages, 8 lives lost. Termed the worst flood in 24 years. I mean, we're back in the 40s and 50s, right? That was an unprecedented flood, the worst flood we've had, millions of dollars in damage. We get to the 60s and 70s. Kerr County experienced major rises almost annually. Flooding ceased to be a generational anomaly and became a persistent logistical crisis. This is back in the 60s and 70s. We have known that flooding and flash flooding has been a persistent problem, an impactful problem, a problem that involves the loss of life and massive property damage. 1978 was a massive flood. Dick references it in his email. Camp Mystic was the most severely damaged. Just again, unprecedented rises in the river, massive damage to the area, and specifically damaged Camp Mystic. 1984, congratulations to Dick and Tweedy. I'm sure they will never forget this flood, as Tweedy had to be airlifted by helicopter to the hospital, an experience never to be forgotten. 1987, another major flood in the area that impacted Camp Mystic greatly. That was the year, I believe, that they lost horses in that flood, and girls were evacuated from cabins into Rec Hall in 1987. I have spoken with 2 women who were campers in one of those cabins in 1987, and she remembers, or they both remember, a very similar process that occurred last year, where Dick showed up in their cabins in the middle of the night, loaded them up into cars, and took them to Rec Hall. So as early as 1987, Bug House and Look Inn were evacuated to Rec Hall. And 2 campers in Look Inn, obviously grown women now, interviewed with me. Part of the camp lore, right? Many people in this room told me about being on Senior Hill when the land bridge would flood, and we liked it because we could stay in our cabins and have food delivered to us by boat. It was novel. It was part of camp lore. This Instagram post, a little flooding on the bridge today. Rain days at camp are the best. Again, this is not... I'm not trying to be negative about this. I'm just saying that it became a very complacent sort of flood culture at Camp Mystic. It was just kind of part of life there. So this is where we have learned a lot about sort of how the camp is situated with respect to waterways. I'm going to get my cursor here. So this is Camp Mystic, right? Right in the middle of this little area. This is the Guadalupe River campus where I'm circling with my cursor. As you go up past these tennis courts and up here, this is the Cypress Lake campus, okay? This is the South Fork of the Guadalupe River flowing in this direction. This is a little dam right here to sort of dam up the waterfront area where the girls swim. Right here is the waterfront area. The river goes over that dam and flows in this direction. This is Cypress Creek, okay? And it flows in this direction and flows into the Guadalupe right here. Goes out that direction. This is a little bit harder to see. Well, but you guys were out there, so you have some perspective now. This is Edmondson Creek, also known as Bubblegum Creek. It was nicknamed Bubblegum Creek by the campers, but it's technically known as Edmondson Creek. So you have Edmondson, it's typically either a dry creek bed or just a very small trickle of water. So you have Edmondson Creek flanking the camp, the Guadalupe campus right here. You have Cypress Creek flanking the Guadalupe River campus right here. You have the Guadalupe River right here. And then this, which it's hard to tell because it's not three-dimensional, is a bluff. This is a hill, but I would say hill is kind of a mild description for what it is. It is a rocky bluff that goes up to, at the very peak, what they call, what Camp Mystic calls Sky High, where that sort of iconic Mystic sign is at the very top of Sky High. So this is a steep hill, and you can obviously see that if all of these waterways are flooding, this is, I mean, I don't know, you could come up with a lot of words for it. It's a choke point, it's a funnel, it's a river canyon. It's called the Flats. So that gives you some perspective of what the waterways are for Camp Mystic. So now we're gonna kind of start to move into the relevant timelines that we've been talking about. It was a really big challenge putting this presentation together because there were so many different areas of the camp that were affected that I think are relevant for your purposes, but we kind of had to split them up into different topics because they were all affected so differently. Each part of the camp, each camper, each cabin had a bit of a different experience. But as far as the common timeline leading into July 3rd and 4th, we're gonna start with June 27th to June 29th for the second term. They had already had one term. This was the second summer term for Camp Mystic, and it's when the counselors began to arrive for orientation. One thing that I think is really important to know that I've learned from witness interviews is how things have changed a little bit about counselors. And just a reminder, I'm sure you guys know this, these are young girls. These are, you're eligible to be a counselor the summer after your senior year of high school. So most of them are 18, but some of them are 17. And we have an example of one of the counselors in one of the relevant cabins being 17. So that was okay to be 17 if you had proper supervision. So there's been this move, according to witnesses, from what used to be, I mean, I can just tell you so many people have said, we always had three counselors per cabin. We always had, it was rare to see two counselors per cabin. We always had three. And I think what has happened as Cypress Lake opened up and they were, you know, spread thin, they had more cabins to man. As young college students, their lives are changing in modern times. Many of them do study abroad now, or they have internships, or they have reasons why they can't spend the summer as a counselor. So I think that I don't know this. It seems like hiring of counselors became a challenge based on what witnesses have told me, because many of the counselors, many of the cabins on July 4th, 2025 had two counselors. Now, there were several that had three, but many of them had only two. And another really important factor that I believe plays into this factually is that those counselors that are eligible to be counselors the summer after their senior year of high school, they are nicknamed ETS, short for Counselor ET. That is a junior first year counselor. A second year counselor is considered a little bit more senior, right? And you might even have a counselor that's done it for two or three summers. And then of course you have the big three, as I mentioned, that are still college age girls, but they are senior counselors. I'm told that it has always been a habit, or and policy might be kind of strong, but certainly a habit, to have a senior counselor with an ET assigned to a cabin. You weren't going to have two ETs alone in a cabin in the past. You were always going to have a senior counselor matched with an ET. Another factor is that in this case, last summer, in the youngest cabins, in Twins 1 and 2 and Bubble, where they were 8 years old, they were first-year campers, those cabins were all manned by ETs. They were all being supervised by first-year counselors. And one of the significant things that I was told that really resonated, obviously, as a mother, is that the 8-year-olds can hardly even wash their own hair, right? They're really high maintenance. They are the most homesick because this is their first year away. Some of them still have, you know, bedwetting issues. They need a lot of supervision in the shower and brushing their teeth. They're very high maintenance. I spoke to a senior counselor who was a counselor on Senior Hill who had a little baby cousin in one of the twins' cabins, and she came down every night to tuck her cousin in, and she saw with her own eyes these counselors struggling with these little babies and saying, oh my gosh, this is so much. Because when the counselors have their nights off, which they all have a schedule of nights off, then an ET will be left alone for several hours with little 8-year-old girls that are very high maintenance. And so this counselor expressed to leadership, hey, I think these counselors are struggling with these babies. They need some help. Chloe Childress and Catherine Ferruzzo, two of the counselors that died in this flood, both expressed concern to their parents in the weeks leading up to camp that they were worried. They had some anxiety about having the littlest campers and not having three counselors. There was actually conversations that they had with their folks about, you know, gosh, this is going to be a lot of work. I'm scared. I'm nervous about being alone. And I know many of you, or all of you probably, are parents. And I, you know, my kids are college age. That 1 year, I mean, you know this, right? That 1 year away from home makes such a huge difference, right? The development and growth between a high school graduate and a freshman in college that comes home that next summer is a tremendous amount of development, which makes sense about how they always did it that way, where there was a senior counselor with an ET, but not last year, unfortunately. Every single person that I've spoken with that are former counselors, current counselors, there was never any real training. There were never drills, no drills of any kind. And you've solved that with some legislation that you passed last year. But it's something to really keep an eye on in terms of what you guys are looking to do, because there was just not a single person that said they were given any information about it. And you look at what we do in schools and have been doing for years with tornado drills and fire drills and active shooter drills. I mean, that's just unthinkable that these girls would have no training. And again, just the real lack of equipment, no radios, no walkie-talkies, no phones, which we can agree is, you know, that they needed radios. No toolkits, no ladders, no life jackets, no real tools to accomplish any kind of emergency preparedness. So there was some things in the counselor binders that reflect that in the past there were three counselors. This information is in the counselor binders. It says for floods, stay in your cabins. You will be informed of proper procedures over the PA system. When in doubt, get help. And then it says at least one counselor should be in the cabin at all times. There was no way for counselors to comply with these rules if there was only two counselors in a cabin, because very often one counselor was on her night off, one counselor was alone with the cabin. And so I had counselors describe to me, if a girl had thrown up at 2 o'clock in the morning, I can't send another 8-year-old to the infirmary at 2 o'clock in the morning. I can't leave to go get help. I have no radio. So even the simplest things require three counselors, right? Even the simplest things. Even a child that's, and there were some, I heard stories about girls that were inconsolable about, you know, seemingly small things, right? But if you have an inconsolable camper and you need help, if your co-counselor's on her night off, you really are kind of stuck with limited options. And leaving a group of 8-year-olds in the middle of the night to get help is, you know, difficult. This is another indication that there was a trend towards having three in the fire drill. This is in the binder in the fire drills. One counselor should be in front of the cabin as they go to the muster site, and two behind. And of course, that makes perfect sense. That's good advice. That is how we make sure that we've rounded up 12, 13, 14, 15 little girls, right? One in front, everybody in line, two behind, we've accounted for everybody. You know, buddy system, whatever. But of course, that requires three. And again, many of these cabins, all of the younger cabins had only two heads. So let's talk a little bit about what they were given in the emergency plan that was provided to counselors. In the case of flood, all campers on Senior Hill must stay in their cabins. And we talked about Senior Hill when we were at the site, and I'll talk a little bit more about it. The reason why Senior Hill seems to have its own part of this paragraph is that Senior Hill was often the area of camp that was cut off from the dining services and the front office, because that land bridge where Cypress Creek and Edmondson Creek converge into the Guadalupe would often have too much water over it for them to safely walk over for meals, right? So Senior Hill must stay in their cabins. They will be given instructions through the loudspeaker, the PA system that we've talked about. If the electricity is off, a walkie-talkie will be used. Part of the problem with that is that they did not have a walkie-talkie. They had a walkie-talkie locked in the riflery range cabinet. Food and other supplies will be delivered to Senior Hill by boat or truck. Campers and counselors, never wander away from your cabin. Those on the flats, so now we have this one line about the flats portion, must also stay in their cabins unless told otherwise by the office. All cabins are constructed on high, safe locations. Regarding training for last year, in the orientation for last year.
I remembered at our orientation, they talked about like the flood protocol and like what you do for it, and like how it's like there's a part in our binder, like a page in our binder that like has instructions for if anything were ever to happen like this. And whenever they were going over it, it's like not funny, but they were like, oh, like, yeah, but like, that's not gonna happen. And I like remember them being like, oh, that's never gonna happen.
And that's not the only counselor that indicated that to me, that there was sort of a, don't worry, that's not gonna happen. So I do wanna talk a little bit about what you guys are obviously very familiar with now, is the relevant portion of the Texas Administrative Code regarding what was required last year. I know you guys made some important changes to that code, but we're talking about what happened last year, and this is the code as it was last year. A written plan of procedures shall be formulated and posted in each permanent and semi-permanent occupied building. So plans shall be written and posted in all buildings. They did have that one-page plan, and it was posted in buildings. The plan must cover four areas: disaster, serious accident, epidemic, or fatality. As you'll see when we get to one of the next slides, their emergency plan.
You've been listening here to Casey Garrett. She's a Fox 26 contributor, but she was also tasked with doing the investigation for the Texas Legislative Committee investigating the deadly Hill Country flooding with a specific focus on Camp Mystic. It is now 11 o'clock, so as we reset here, we want to come back out and just say good morning to you. We are going to go back out to that hearing in just a moment because she's really laying out the timeline of the facts, because she wants lawmakers to know everything so that they can be prepared and that they can take a look at the response and see the failures and see what needs to be addressed so that this doesn't happen again. We also, though, want to get you a quick update on the forecast. Instead of forecasting with friends, Mike, we are going to take viewers back to that hearing, but quickly tell us what we can expect this week.
Well, let's get into it. It's going to be kind of broken up into two pieces. The first one is very warm and humid with storms to our north, and then the second part of the week is going to be cooler and rainier with storms moving into our area. So here we go. Today is going to be one of the days with big storms off to our north and east. This is a look at around 4 in the afternoon. So a chance for a few isolated storms even up around the Livingston area for us, but heavy storms in Louisiana and widespread severe weather across the Midwest. So around here, warm, humid, breezy, and maybe the warmest day that we've had so far this year. We'll have another chance heading into tomorrow. Severe weather chances late today to the north of Bryan College Station, heading up to Groveton, Madisonville, Hearn, Trinity, and those spots, so watch out for that. But the highest chance is going to be just bullseye right here on the Midwest, with not only a high chance for wind damages, and there's already been a lot of straight line producing wind damage type storms, but also for the formation of tornadoes there later on today. Our temperatures continue to move up around 80 to 84 right now on our way toward highs near 90 degrees. We are running just a little bit warmer now than we were this time yesterday. So pretty close to 90 today, tomorrow, Wednesday. Some storms are possible to our north today and tomorrow. More numerous Wednesday, mostly north of Houston. Temperatures are not going to be as hot on Thursday with some lingering showers and some clouds. Friday is a transition day when we have a front coming in that'll bring us some thunderstorms, maybe a couple of hefty ones, followed by a much cooler weekend. So, Sally, that's about how things are shaping up here. It's going to be a bit topsy-turvy.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's take you back to Austin in the state capitol now, where they're holding this hearing on the deadly flooding from almost a year ago, July the 4th. Casey Garrett, the investigator who she says interviewed more than 100 witnesses to put together a timeline and the most detailed picture of what occurred in the early morning hours of July 4th, continues to lay out her findings for lawmakers. We'll take you back there now.